طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر، من مخيم.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. The demolition of homes and villages by the Israeli military is a constant in the lives of the Palestinian people. Lately, in particular, we hear of the focus of this barbarity on Bedouin villages as Israel continues to illegally take land in the West Bank to build their settlements. In the news for the last several weeks is the plight of Khan al-Ahmar, a Bedouin village where, so far, a successful stand is being made to save the village from demolition. A large, around-the-clock presence by the international community, plus constant coverage by the press, has made the Israelis again and again postpone their assault on the village. I want to read a Monda Weiss article written by Yumna Patel, a multimedia journalist based in Bethlehem, that describes what this proposed demolition means to the people of Khan al-Ahmar. She writes, "After nearly 2 months on high alert, the fear of imminent demolition permanently lingering on the air, the residents of Khan al-Ahmar and the activists supporting them took a collective, albeit temporary, sigh of relief last week. When the news that the Israeli government was postponing the demolition of the village until further notice, the Bedouins of Khan al-Ahmar, along with hundreds of activists and Palestinian government officials, rejoiced. Men carried each other on their shoulders and chanted national slogans in celebration, and activists hailed the development as a win for grassroots organizing. After 40 to 50 days of constant stress, there is a sense of relief," a spokesperson for Awad Asaf, the head of the National Committee to Resist the War and Settlements, told Mondo Weiss. "The village was an extremely stressful environment, especially for the women and children. Now there is a slight feeling of calm, but the people do not trust the Israeli occupation and will not feel completely relaxed until there is an official reversal of the demolition order," he said. In the days since Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu's security cabinet approved the postponement, the hundreds of journalists and activists who had been camping for weeks in the village have slowly emptied out of Khan al-Ahmar. Now, as the euphoria of the postponement wears off, the residents of Khan al-Ahmar are back trying to resume their daily lives as normal until the next decision comes. Khan al-Ahmar is the home of some 200 Palestinian Bedouins from the Jahalin tribe, who maintain a semi-nomadic shepherding lifestyle. Dozens of the men in the village work construction jobs inside Israel to support their families. Over the past few months, many men have lost their jobs as a result of not showing up to work, further worsening the already fragile economic situation in the village. Every day the men would get up and go to work, But then we would get news that maybe they would destroy the village that day. Ahmad Ibrahim Abba Dahoud, 40, a resident of the village who worked in the construction, told Mondo Weiss. When you see the soldiers coming and waiting around the village, how can you leave your wife and children to go to work knowing maybe something will happen? He asked. For this reason, many of the men did not go to work, and then they were fired from their jobs. Abu Dahoud, father of 7, hasn't had a steady job in over a year, ever since the Israeli work permit was revoked in July 2017. During confrontations with the soldiers, I was arrested along with 6 other men from the village, he said. When they released us, they revoked our work permits. Abu Dahoud added that several men have been denied multiple times by Israeli authorities when attempting to renew their expired permits. The Israelis had been threatening us for years before, saying if we didn't leave our homes, they would revoke all our permits, he said. But now they are actually doing it, and it is affecting us a lot. We are being punished because we refuse to let them kick us out of our homes. Abu Dahoud told Mondo Weiss that for the last few months, the Palestinian Authority has been paying a 1,000 shekel, that's $269, a month stipend to each family in the village in an effort to help alleviate the financial strain on families. We appreciate the money, but we are a family of 9. Many of the families in the village are at least 10 people per family. This money isn't enough to put food on the table, he said. This stipend from the Palestinian Authority is not steady income. Now, with a postponement and people's attention elsewhere, we are not sure if we will even get the money next month, he said. We are just struggling against being displaced. We are struggling to survive every day. On top of worrying about how he's going to put food on the table, Abu Dahoud says one of his main concerns is trying to keep his kids focused on their studies. The past 2 months have most affected the children in the village, he said, noting that the village school has been serving as one of the main campsites in the village for activists and journalists. For weeks after the High Court gave the final green light to demolish Khan al-Ahmar, local and foreign activists camped overnight in the village schoolyard. The kids have been distracted by the constant crowds of foreigners and journalists spending day and night in the village since September, and it has taken a toll on their schoolwork, he said. My kids wake up in the morning and they don't want to go to school, and when they come home, they don't want to study, he said. They tell me and my wife, why should we go to school? We will study tonight and tomorrow, and they will destroy our school. So what's the point? The principal of the school echoed similar sentiments to Mondo Weiss, saying that since the High Court gave the final green light to demolish the village in September, she has noticed a significant change in the behavior of the children. The children are always scared and distracted, especially when there are confrontations with the soldiers, she said. They don't want to be in the classroom. They want to be outside and see what's going on. We try to calm them down, but they have become noticeably more aggressive and stubborn since the demolition has become more imminent, she said. Now, after the postponement, they are a little more calm than they have been in the past 2 months, but things are still not back to normal. The school in Khan al-Ahmar, which was built in 2009, serves more than 150 children between the ages of 6 and 15 from the village and surrounding Bedouin communities. Before the Khan al-Ahmar school, which is made of mud and rubber tires, was opened, children from the village had to travel far distances to go to school in other communities. Prior to 2009, only boys would go to school because the families did not agree to let their daughters travel far from home. There were girls that were 17, 18 years old and could not read or write properly. But that all changed when the school was built in the village. With the schools close by, families began to break with decades of customs and traditions in the community and started sending their girls to school. It has not only changed the lives of the girls, but the entire community, she said. Abu Daoud, whose girls go to the village school, says he has seen a shift in the mindset of the community since the school was built. Now the girls have started to study, and the minds of the people have started changing about educating girls, and some are even thinking about letting their girls go to the university, he said, noting that the girls in the village typically bring home higher averages than the boys. But if the school is demolished, I think things will go back to how they were before, unfortunately, he said. Dahalka expressed similar fears. If they demolish the school, the girls will stop studying, she said. Many of the girls have already expressed fears that the families will not let them go to Jericho to study if the school is destroyed, and they will have to stay at home and take care of livestock while the boys go to school. While the residents of Khan al-Ahmar attempt to restore a sense of normalcy to their village, daily life is still very much defined by the looming threat of demolition. Israeli news website Haaretz reported that the deliberations regarding demolition plans were at a standstill, as Israel is refusing to negotiate with the village's lawyer because he is employed by the Palestinian Authority. Despite no known developments in negotiations between the villagers and the Israeli government, activists are staying vigilant, with many saying they don't trust the Israeli government on its word that the demolition will not happen anytime soon. Though their numbers have significantly dwindled since the postponement was announced, a steady stream of activists have continued to filter in and out of the village and are now preparing for spending many cold winter nights at Khan al-Ahmar. We have set up new waterproof tents in the village for activists and have brought in new mattresses and heaters, Al-Rafai told Mondo Weiss. We believe that the presence of international activists who have come in the thousands to Khan al-Ahmar over the past months is crucial to fighting the demolition of the village, he said. I do believe that the work of activists and the pressure they put on the international community, specifically European countries, played a role in delaying the demolition, he said, adding that activists are remaining cautiously optimistic. We can be happy, but we need to be careful about how we celebrate because there is still a real danger of demolition, he said. Our goal is to keep working against this demolition order until the Israelis reverse their decision and say that Khan al-Ahmar will not be destroyed, not now and not in the future. That was an article from the news service Mondo Weiss concerning the threatened demolition of the Bedouin village of Khan al-Ahmar. And now on to our feature presentation this morning, which is a recording of a presentation entitled The Fake Peace Process, delivered at a conference at the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs by Khalil Jashan, who, among other things, is the executive director of the Arabic Center in Washington, D.C. It begins with his introduction.
Hello. For anyone just joining us, I'm Janet McMahon, Managing Editor of the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. When I first interviewed our next speaker in 1991, Khalil Jashan was the Executive Director of the National Association of Arab Americans, or NAAA, which lobbied Congress and the executive branch on behalf of immigrants and their descendants from 21 highly diverse Arab states. A lobby, he explained, must keep track of every decision, every piece of legislation, and plug into the process on day one. NAAA's research arm monitored everything in Washington, Khalil said, hearings, votes, speeches, think tank activities, etc. That's quite an undertaking. I didn't ask at the time, but I suspect that his organization operated on something less than AIPAC's staff of 451, an annual budget of $89 million. Is that a fair assumption?
Very fair. Okay. Very fair.
Today, Khalil, who was born in Nazareth, Palestine, is executive director of the Arab Center, Washington, D.C., a position he has held since its founding in 2014. He previously was a lecturer in international studies and languages at Pepperdine University and executive director of its Seaver College, Washington, D.C. internship program. He also has served as executive vice president of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, or ADC, Vice President of the American Committee on Jerusalem, and National Director of the Association of Arab American University Graduates. Khalil has brought his wealth of experience and expertise to the Arab Center, a nonprofit, independent, and nonpartisan research center focusing on the Arab world. Those of us who live in the D.C. area have also benefited from the center's many excellent and thought-provoking programs on timely and important issues. One of the issues we seem to hear about incessantly these days is fake news. At this gathering, Khalil will discuss the Israel lobby and fake peace processing. Please join me in welcoming Khalil Jashan.
Thank you, Janet. I would like to begin by thanking the American Educational Trust and the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs for organizing this great event for the fourth year and for inviting me this time to participate in this very specific panel, important panel, dealing with peacemaking in the Middle East. I have great personal respect for this organization, its founders, and current leaders for their principled positions, an unwavering commitment over the years to real, just, and lasting peace in the region, actually for more than 37 years since I first came to town and met Dick Curtis and Andy Kilgore, and we worked together from the very beginning. So I'm indeed personally very honored to be with you today. On June 5th, 2017, in 72 days precisely, the world marks the 50th anniversary of the 1967 occupation of Israel, by Israel, of the Palestinian territories of the West Bank and Gaza, including Jerusalem. The occupation, initially portrayed by Israeli leaders at the time as a temporary measure, has become clearly, for all those who particularly visit the area, for all practical purposes, it has become permanent. Of course, notwithstanding the arrogant statement at the time, Defense Minister Moshe Dayan, in an interview in 1967 on the last day of the war on the BBC that became infamous as he displayed his intoxication with his own Pyrrhic victory at the time, and saying, and I'm quoting him, "We are waiting for a phone call from the Arabs," end of quote, looking for a peace deal. Needless to say, the phone never rang for good reasons and clear reasons. Dayan is no longer with us, but Israel's military occupation remains as pervasive and as deeply entrenched as ever, to the detriment of Arab, Israeli, and American interests alike. Realistic expectation of just peacemaking today has become an expression of utter naivete and a total disregard of facts on the ground. The situation in Palestine as we speak today is quite dismal. Most experts agree that the economic, and I'm sure you've heard today from different people on this subject, most experts agree that the economic, humanitarian, political, and security situation in occupied Palestine is quite untenable. The protracted dehumanization, internal colonization, and dispossession of the Palestinian people cannot be sustained indefinitely. This is not stemming purely in a selfish way from Palestinian analysis or interest, but even some Israeli scholars and officials have come to the same conclusion. As a matter of fact, I was surprised this week to read an article on Tuesday this week by former Mossad chief Tamir Pardo, no peacenik by any stretch of the imagination, declaring on the 21st of March that, and I'm quoting him, "Israel has chosen not to choose, hoping the conflict will resolve itself. Perhaps the Arabs will disappear. Maybe some cosmic miracle will happen. One day we will become a binational state because it will be impossible to untie the Gordian knot between the two peoples. This is not the way to decide." Pardo stated in Haaretz, "Israel has one existential threat. It is a ticking bomb. We have chosen to stick our head in the sand, creating a variety of external threats. Israel," he concluded, "must deal with the demographic reality and decide which state we want to be. Life," and I hate that he borrowed from Trump, "but life with alternative facts harbors a disaster for the Zionist vision." I'm glad he did, actually, because it kind of puts it in terms we're familiar with in this town. Serious predicament indeed, but who's responsible for this predicament? In order to be fair, objectively speaking, that is, there is an abundant amount of blame to assign to all the parties to the conflict. One, Israel, Israeli intransigence, an insatiable appetite for land, particularly other people's land, land that doesn't belong to Israelis, I think has been one of the main reasons for the impediment that we are facing today. Two, on the Palestinian side, I believe that weak leadership and lack of vision and political will to end Israeli occupation instead of contributing to it in many different ways has also contributed to the protracted nature of this predicament. Three, the Arab world. The Arab world cannot escape some responsibility for what's happening today, particularly with its current preoccupation with internal narrow interests and collective resignation from the historic Arab commitment to the Palestine cause. Four, the world community itself, including the United Nations, and it has given us more evidence the past few days in terms of even refusing to condone or to support an internal report by a UN agency with regards to discrimination and apartheid in Israel, neglecting its responsibilities under international law by the United Nations and its agencies, I think has also contributed to this predicament. Last but not least, which is the subject of our discussion today, is the U.S. and U.S. policy. The United States, by losing track of its own national interests, despite the warning that our first president warned us of, not to fall in love or to hate any other nation where you can become a slave to that love or hatred relationship, and you lose track of your interest, we have done exactly so in that bilateral relationship between Washington and Tel Aviv. By losing track of its own national interest, by reducing itself to a biased active party in the Arab-Israeli conflict, thus the United States disqualified itself from playing any constructive role in any potential political process, with all due respect to people who are addicted to peacemaking a la U.S. In the Middle East. As we all know, the U.S., of course, is not a newcomer to Middle East peacemaking. The U.S. has been dabbling with trying to find a solution, a political solution, to the Palestine question since 1937, 11 years before the creation of the State of Israel. This is one of those unique, weird conflicts where peacemaking started 11 years before the actual conflict started, in the sense that the international community began to anticipate trouble brewing in Palestine as they began to talk about ending the mandate, and the Peel Commission was formed and proposed its partition plan, first partition plan, in 1937, followed 10 years later by the other partition plan that was considered by the United Nations. So Arab-Israeli peacemaking, as far as the United States is concerned, has been an American national sport for every U.S. administration since 1948. For those of you who are not aware of the history of peacemaking in the Middle East, the threatened peace plan that is supposed to be released in about 3 weeks or so, I'll talk about it in a few minutes, is going to be the number 76, the 76th attempt at resolving the Arab-Israeli conflict since 1937. Many of these plans were American plans that were proposed, almost every administration. You know, you guys might remember, old-timers, remember the Johnson administration, the Carter administration, the Reagan administration, the Rogers plan, name it. Every administration since 1948 has had a plan named after its Secretary of State. Yet, where do we find all these plans? This huge cemetery of peace processes in the Middle East. And it behooves us as students of history, as political activists, as active citizens, as historians, as political scientists, to ask why? Why this huge cemetery? Why this dismal failure over the years? And as I said, Washington has proposed more peace proposals during this period than any other stakeholder in the conflict. Yet, in practical terms, the American contribution to effecting a peace solution to the Arab-Israeli conflict has been lackluster. At best, lacking in vitality, political force, and moral conviction above all. Since its inception, AIPAC has been the great facilitator, the advocate, the enforcer of Israeli policies and American peacemaking efforts between Israel and Palestine as part of and parcel of its, of course, larger agenda dealing with U.S.-Israeli bilateral relationship. AIPAC's platform on Middle East peace is essentially very simple. Although the organization has been gradually, for those of you who have been noticing, downgrading its commitment to a two-state solution, kind of quietly the past couple of years, the term has disappeared at least from the front page on the website. It's still in there, but you have to look for it these days in order to reflect basically, or out of deference, to change in Israeli policy, downplaying, if you will, the two-state solution. So AIPAC's lobbying efforts remain focused on essentially, at the risk of oversimplification, I would say, a four-prong approach. One, two states for two people. It's still there. It's not the number one kind of priority, but it's still in the background. In other words, but their definition of it is slightly different than most of us in this room, if not all of us. A Jewish state of Israel, Jewish state of Israel, living in peace with a demilitarized Palestinian state. Two, only direct talks between the parties can lead to a real and lasting peace. Okay, fine. Depends what you mean by real and lasting peace, but that's another story. Three, the U.S. can play an important facilitating role, but it cannot dictate the terms of peace. AIPAC wants to have its cake, and it wants to eat it too. It wants the U.S. to dominate the process as the sole legitimate peacemaker in the Middle East, but it doesn't want it to dictate I don't know if Trump will change that. You know, he keeps saying, if you pay the bill, you have the right to dictate, but we'll see. I doubt it. 4, Arab states must take an active and constructive role by normalizing relations with Israel. This is a very important and dangerous item that was added more recently on AIPAC's agenda in an attempt to finally kind of liquidate, if you will, the Palestinian cause and replace Palestine as the core of the Arab-Israeli conflict with basically Arab-Israeli peace. Peace between Israel and Arab states, where there is no territorial compromise involved and there is no solution to the Palestine problem, in other words. Let's talk just for a couple of minutes about the failure of past U.S. efforts. Why? I think basically, as an observer of these series of processes, fake or otherwise, most of them are fake, I could summarize probably the reasons into 5 main reasons. 1, American lack of even-handedness and bias toward Israel from the very beginning. For various domestic, political, cultural, and ideological reasons, Washington is not, has never been, and will never be a neutral arbiter or mediator in the Arab-Israeli conflict, ladies and gentlemen. 2, vague objectives with regards to ending Israel's occupation of Palestinian territories, establishing a Palestinian state, confronting all the permanent status issues such as boundaries, Jerusalem, refugees, settlements, water, without these core issues being at the heart of a process that's not a genuine peace process. And that's why many of these processes we have seen, they might have started on the right track, but they quickly ended up being fake peace processes rather than realistic ones. 3, the open-ended and protracted nature of American peace processing, lacking clear and enforceable mechanisms and timelines. I missed Hanan's speech earlier, but she has made this point year after year clearly for many, many years in her book, in her presentations, in her interviews. This absence of mechanisms, enforcement mechanisms, and timetables have been the enemy of peacemaking and negotiations in the Middle East as a negotiator. 4, consistently allowing Israel to dictate the terms of reference governing the process and vetoing any attempt, whether by the Palestinians or the international community, to change that pattern. That has dogged us from day one and will continue, I think, unless there is a serious change in policy by whatever party is trying to mediate the conflict in the future. And 5, acquiescence to Israeli demands at every difficult juncture in the process. How many times have we seen and witnessed throughout these negotiation processes where the Israelis would say, no, it doesn't matter who it is, Rabin or Shamir or Sharon or Netanyahu, whenever an Israeli leader comes in and says no, the U.S. tucks its tail between its legs and takes a step back and lowers the ceiling of the terms of reference and the expectation. That has been also detrimental to attempts at peacemaking in the Middle East. What's next? With the rest of the balance of my time, let me just quickly speculate about what I anticipate over the next three or four weeks with regards, not years, otherwise we'll be here till next week, with regards to the rumored, I call it the Trump-Kushner-Greenblatt plan. So there's a new one for you. Number 76, okay? As all of you are aware, President Trump dispatched his envoy to the Middle East peace process, Jason Greenblatt, to the region for about 4 days to listen, learn, and explore, according to the White House, with various sides, the potential for resumed American-led process. As if, after all these years, okay, we still need to listen, to learn, and to explore, okay? We are told that the White House Energizer money, Mr. Greenblatt, who lacks any diplomatic experience, by the way, convinced the parties that Trump's of Trump's seriousness and solicited enough support in principle to justify the just concluded yesterday talks secretly held here in Washington between an Israeli security delegation and the administration with regards to what is possible down the road, particularly with regards to settlement. Of course, Netanyahu, who is in China, was quick to say no change in settlement policy. So to make sure that nobody misunderstands what his delegation did here in town. In addition, of course, the Arab side has also responded positively to the Trump administration, and you're going to see a rash of Arab leaders coming to town. King Abdullah of Jordan, after, of course, the Arab summit in Amman, before is, of course, President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi of Egypt, and then, of course, Mahmoud Abbas of Palestine, to follow by mid-April. The administration is talking about a draft paper, okay? What's in this draft paper? Of course, as you know, most plans that Trump has come up with, whether during the campaign or since his arrival at the White House, are still secret. We don't know any of his plans. He doesn't announce anything. But there is a draft paper. People in town are talking about it. Let me tell you what I heard through the rumor mill in town as to what it involves. And compare that with what I said earlier about the detriment to peacemaking in the Middle East. Because it looks like that this administration is about to repeat the same mistakes, but maybe in a more intensive way than what we have done over the past 58 years, okay? So there is no change at all, okay? One, Trump basically in his paper tells his counterparts in the Arab world and in Palestine and Israel, he wants to assure them that he is seriously committed to Arab-Israeli peace and will personally get involved in the process. If that doesn't convince you to stay home, I don't know what will. That's the scariest part of the plan. Two, the paper talks about pursuing sustained security for Israel and a provisional entity. There we are. After all these processes, we're back talking about like 15, 20 years ago, a provisional entity for Palestinians without even a definite article, not a two-state solution, retreat, because after all, he's for one state, two states, whatever you guys want. And hints in the paper at working within that framework. Okay? I mean, even Oslo did not get that low in doublespeak. Okay? Three, the Palestinians will be promised continued financial and technical support in return for full cooperation with Israel if they end incitement and they resume their counterterrorism cooperation with the U.S. and with Israel. Palestinians will be asked, of course, also, are being asked in the paper, to cease all, this comes from pressure from Congress, actually, all legal campaigns against Israel in international courts and fora at this time. No complaining about Israeli occupation anymore. Four, the plan seeks a phased and transitional approach, not an end of conflict arrangement. Another major retreat from previous processes that failed. Five, the plan expresses general concern about continued Israeli settlements, but falls short of calling for a freeze. Indeed, the Israeli delegation negotiating here in town that I mentioned earlier with the Trump administration talked about, quote, a construction slowdown, but insisted, without distinguishing inside the settlements or outside the settlements. Sometimes they do that. They go into these technicalities. But this time, even without bothering to distinguish, just a construction slowdown, but insisted that settlement freeze, particularly in Jerusalem, I'm quoting Mr. Netanyahu and his team here, is off the table. Okay? So tell me who wags whom. Six, the Arab Peace Initiative that came few years back in the early 90s from Arab sources, the Arab League, Saudi Arabia, and so on, the Arab Peace Initiative will be given this time a central role, a central prominence in this plan, in order, not again to balance things, but in order to refocus the process away from being focused solely on Palestine, which is the problem at stake, okay? I mean, we're not going to go have a peace process about Palestine and discuss Puerto Rico, okay? It's not relevant. So remove Palestine as the core of the process and put the Arab Peace Initiative instead. My advice to you is to watch the deliberations of the Arab Summit, the 28th Arab Summit, that will be held on the 29th of this month, because that is going to be where the preparation is going to take place before announcing this plan. So, ladies and gentlemen, lots of mistakes have been made. The reasons are very clear to any objective student of peacemaking in the Middle East. Lessons have not been learned. So don't blame me for not being optimistic about this next plan over the next few weeks. Thank you.
If people have questions and want to write them on the cards and pass them to the ushers, then they'll bring them up here. And I'll start by asking what might be a very naive question. What is the origin and the general acceptance of the idea that the U.S. has to be involved for there to be a viable peace process? Where did that come from?
Arrogance. If you allow me to be frank about it, basically the U.S., in order to assert itself as the protector of Israel, has declared itself many years ago when these peace processes, peace plan after peace plan, was emerging, and as Israel kept basically turning down these offers, and the U.S. decided to arrogate to itself the role of the sole legitimate peacemaker in the Middle East, and has refused to even allow our closest allies, Europe, whenever the French pop their head, shut up, carry the dust, the pan, and the broom, and clean after us. That's what Europeans have been told, and unfortunately they have abided by that. That's one of my criticisms of European policy. It's much more progressive policy on Palestine than the U.S. policy, but they're not willing to take initiative. So the U.S. Prevented also the U.N. from doing so, and we're facing the same question today. Should there be a peace process over the next few weeks? Again, rest assured that the U.S. will not allow any other party to share in basically directing, if you will, or mediating or participating in the management of that process.
Do you think that this idea originated with the Israel lobby or with just the U.S. as wanting to be a superpower? Or?
Frankly, the Israel lobby and its influence. Let me tell you something. My first lesson as a lobbyist when I arrived in town, a young, somewhat still innocent young man, my first meeting with a senator, Senator Hatfield. I was not with any Arab American organization yet at the time, and I was basically serving as an academic advisor to a group of church leaders in this country. I participated with them in advocating for basically peace and justice in the Middle East. And they asked me to accompany them as a resource person to meeting with a series of leaders in Congress. The late Senator Hatfield of Oregon listened to us and then asked me to stay after the group decided to leave. I did. He looked at me, he said, "What are you going to do?" I said, "Well, I'm moving to town and I'm going to work on behalf of Arab causes and particularly my cause, the Palestinian cause." And he looked at me like, established eye contact with me, and he said, "Young man, this is a very difficult task you're embarking on." And he said, and I will never forget these words, as long as I live. He said, "In this great, distinguished institution of the United States Senate, when the Israel lobby says jump, 90-plus of my colleagues say how high. They never ask why. So with that type of control, particularly in Congress, you can't tell where the idea came from, whether it's volunteered by these people who are more than willing to sell out morally and politically, or from the lobby, or how the two kind of feed, if you will, on each other. The second point, quickly, the issue of the two-state solution. Why is it that most of the time in recent history, I have a higher percentage of Knesset members in Israel that support the two-state solution than I do in the U.S. Congress of America? Ask yourself that question. We've never exceeded 60, 70, 80 members of the U.S. Congress out of 435, both houses, right? In Israel, the number was at 70 or 80 at one point out of 120. It shifts, and people mean different things, of course, by state, two states. They're not all in harmony. But it's a good question to ask, I think. As American citizens, it behooves us to ask and to understand the answer to that question. Thank you.
Okay, let me ask you this final question then. How do we move from conflict management to conflict resolution? BDS, the Arab Initiative, what other routes are available to us?
I don't think so. We haven't moved yet. It'll probably, unfortunately, take much longer to do so. But BDS is a very interesting concept that it's having its effectiveness and its impact, at least on the Israeli psyche. Some Israelis have problems support it in terms of targeting the settlements. Some Israelis do not because they see it as a disguised attempt to boycott all of Israel together. But it's beginning to have an impact. I mean, today, it is not accidental that the Prime Minister of Israel and most of its national security leaders view the BDS as the number one national security kind of threat to the state of Israel, because it's exposing it worldwide in no uncertain terms to the fact that occupation got to end, occupation cannot be tolerated, and the more clarity there is associated with that, I think the more effective the campaign would be and the more attractive it would become, particularly here in the U.S.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank Khalil Dushan.
You have been listening to Khalil Dushan, Executive Director of the Arabic Center in Washington, D.C. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.